If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Occult Disney. In this series, we break down all of the feature-length Disney animations, the original stories they were based on, how and why they differ, rumored hidden subliminal messages, and occult symbolism. If you love this content from Paranoid American, don't forget to rate us on your podcast platform. Want to go even deeper? Join the Paranoid American Patreon for early access to episodes, exclusive videos, sneak peeks of upcoming comics, and free sticker packs. Don't miss out on this all-access pass to the mysteries and magic behind the scenes. Visit ParanoidAmerican.com and help support a veteran-owned independent publisher creating original content and comics. Do it today. That's ParanoidAmerican.com.
Hello, welcome to the Occult Disney Podcast. I'm just calling it that at this point. This is Matt.
We'll make it work.
Matt Comage is here. Joining me as usual for this run is Thomas Gorenz, the Paranoid American. How are you?
Good, good. Hello, hello.
Groovy. So, we were kind of talking about the 40s is kind of like a weird time for Disney. So we did up to Bambi. It was like easy. It's like an easy, you know, sketch line to follow. So the rules seem to be best to go with the next big full-length feature production, which would be Cinderella. But this one would just stuck out like a sore thumb, victory through air power, and seemed kind of important to talk about.
Well, and also, I'm a sucker for chronology, so I think this one technically comes before Cinderella. So if we were going to cover it at all, I would have always regretted not doing it in chronological order, just out of my own OCD.
No, same here. But just a few of the ones we're skipping. I forget the Saludos Amigos, Three Caballeros, which they have some live action and they're kind of compiled. There's what Make Mine Music.
It's actually not horrible. Out of all of the spectrum we could cover, it's not the worst. And it actually had a decent representation at Epcot, too.
Oh, yeah. I love that ride.
Yeah, the ride is great, but anyways, I don't think it's worth covering compared to everything else that we've got out in front of us.
Yeah, sorry, Jack. It's horrible as a movie. Like, if you're like, I'm watching a compilation of cartoons, it's kind of okay. But yeah, because I guess Mr. Toad is also that way. That was the one where I had to like actually research and be like, oh, is Mr. Toad like a proper one that I just missed on the radar? And I'm like, no, it's not quite the, you know, full production thing. And yeah, yeah. It, two white guys don't need to sit around and talk about Song of the South. So also mostly live action. Let's remember, it doesn't have that much animation. So
although I will say Splash Mountain was by far the greatest ride at Disney World, even compared to Space Mountain and the mountain roller coaster one. I forgot, Thunder Mountain, whatever it was called. Splash Mountain will always forever in my mind be the best ride that they ever had there. And I know that I think they've rebranded it already.
Oh, have they? Okay. Tokyo, maybe they haven't. Cause that one was especially fun. You know, I'm from Atlanta, so that's the hometown stories or whatever.
And, have you been to both? Have you been to Splash Mountain on in both continents?
That's right. And, but they're all speaking Japanese in Tokyo, right?
But is the ride pretty much the same experience?
Yeah. It's just, it's in Japanese and everything okay. else is the same.
All the way to like the big drop in front of the,
yep.
The vines.
It's more like the Disney World version, I think, which is a little shorter. So I think the land one's a little longer, or maybe it's the other
I've
way
never been to the land one. I've only been to the Disney World version.
Those are slightly different. I think Tokyo is a clone of the Florida one, but yeah.
So recap for Song of the South, the best things that have come out of it, if we ignore Uncle Remus and all of the criticism around it, is that A, Splash Mountain was an awesome ride. And the, I believe, Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, was from Song of the South, was it not?
No, sorry,
Mary Poppins. Which is the one from Song of the South?
Zippity-doo-dah.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So that was a good earwig. But yeah, outside of that, we're just going to skip over the rest of that movie. I can't even quite remember what it's about.
But yeah, I took my wife on Splash Mountain, like when we were like, I guess, first dating or just got married. This is a while back, but she hates roller coasters. And it was fun because after the drop, she was like screaming at all the animals, being like, "You lied to me. You said it was going to be okay, and it wasn't." So she was not a fan of Splash Mountain. I think that was my pitch. I was like, "Oh, you gotta get on it because it has like, you know, like the folk tales from like my hometown, right?" So
it always had such a creepy vibe to it, it was obviously intentional because the whole story is that you're with Briar Rabbit. And it's getting hunted by, you know, the fox and the bear, I believe. I might be getting something wrong. I'm pretty sure it's fox and a bear. And but it's like everything is like so, you know, fantastical and cutesy and like fun things. But then there's also like a fox with a rifle like aimed at you halfway through the ride or something like that.
I don't know if you've been to Six Flags Over Georgia, but they had the Monster Plantation ride. You've been on the Monster Plantation?
That one doesn't ring a bell, but I've been to the Six Flags in Atlanta because that's my second favorite ride. There was a huge like glass elevator looking thing, and I think it was called Free Fall, and it just dropped straight down and like slid on its back so that it never actually stopped.
Right. Yeah. That was
I think a kid died on that within the last decade too. Like it was just too much.
Anyway, if you make it back, the Monster Plantation's fun. It's, you know, it's like a 70s vintage dark ride. I mean, maybe they've made some updates and it just has a little drop in the end. It's not like a mountain, but it's basically like a Splash Mountain on like bad mushrooms or something.
That sounds right up my alley, man. I'm actually a little bit bummed that I didn't go there because I'd been to that Six Flags two or three times, I think.
Of course, you can, you know, these days you say ride and you find a ride through on YouTube, no problem, right? So if you just want to
it's not catch the same.
It's not the same. I get that, but yeah. But I've been on. Yeah, it's kind of fun. Like I'm not going to be in Florida anytime soon. So I took a look at like the, you know, Star Wars ride throughs because I'm like, I'm not going to be on those anytime in the near future. So, but yes, it's not the same. I get that. Let's move towards our victory through Air Power. Financially, one of Disney's biggest flops, but I suppose it achieved its purpose, so it wasn't a flop in that way. Maybe
that's interesting. I don't know a lot of the production background of this one. I didn't look into it, but I would have assumed that this wasn't a commercial creation. This was probably made for / funded by the government. Was it not?
Not quite. The government was funding, of course, a lot of the Disney wartime films, you know, the training films, things like this. Mm-hmm. But this was actually one of the reasons I was like, we really should hit this, is this was straight up like Disney's own project. Like he had come across the book, I didn't write his name now because I'm an idiot, but Seversky, that's it. So he'd read Seversky's book and was like, oh, I this is what we should do. And I think he basically put his own money towards making this.
Interesting. I didn't know that. I didn't have that context. So I was, as I was watching this, I was truly constantly between like, is this something that someone's seeing in a theater, or is this something that like a recruit is being forced to watch as part of training? Like, where it's weird. It like lives in between those two things without the context. So who was the ultimate target audience for this?
This was going to be a like in theater thing, but the distributor, which maybe it's RKO at the time, I don't remember, but this, you know, Disney didn't distribute its own movies yet, and the distributor
RKO was almost all of their cartoons at least.
Yeah, so they were basically like, no, they were like, this thing's not going to make any money, no way, you know, we're not even going to bother putting it out. So Disney went out of his way, I think, to have it shown in a few theaters, and Winston Churchill happened to see it, and then when he was in Toronto, like, had a copy shipped over to show Roosevelt. So that was the intended audience in the end.
I mean, I'm paranoid American, and I'm always big in the conspiracy theories. So like, you won't ever be able to convince me that the government didn't have some hand in facilitating this, even if it looks like a Disney like personal thing, because this was legitimately there was a boring aspect to it, just because by nature anything that's educational just kind of like bores me by default, you know. it's not the fault of whoever's trying to do the teaching, it's just like an instant reaction. But the animation at times was pretty decent, but the images and the concepts that they were conveying was awesome. Like, I've seen many, many training films and infographics, you know, throughout all my years so far. And this one's up there. I would put this in like the top 10 of taking a very complicated series of concepts and visually showing them in a very clear and concise way, so that you know, like the average dummy like myself can completely understand it. At least what the idea they're trying to convey, I can understand.
Yeah, there could be deeper things like you mentioned, but for me, it's almost like an on the nose conspiracy. Like, we have this industrialist like directly trying to influence, you know, the what's happening in geopolitics. So I'm like, there could be deeper levels for sure, but I'm like, it's actually that technically is a conspiracy to start with, you know, like the film itself is like, it's just not a secret one.
I would almost equate it to like, you know, on social media or something, you can target, you know, like the top 1% of, you know, bankers or something in a certain city. And even though you're advertising it to, you know, all of Facebook, quote unquote, you're targeting like this, you're essentially targeting like one person in one city, right? Like, you can get that specific. And that could be kind of what Disney was doing here, where, yeah, I'm going to make this thing and it looks like it's for mass audiences, but I really just need it to be seen by like one of 200 people on the planet. And if one of those people sees it and likes it, then it opens up a new dialogue. And because it's funny, on a slightly related tangent here, I was watching a bunch of videos on Disney's original ideas for Epcot and how it was truly like some industrialist mad scientist kind of thinking. Like, they were going to put like a glass dome over the building, they were going to have no retirees, everyone had to be employed full time in order to live inside this Epcot city. Like, it was like a completely fabricated industrialist, you know, paradise, where the second that you could no longer contribute to the society actively, you just like, they move you out somehow. You know,
but yeah, another thing with this movie in particular is when you give it a few minutes thought, especially once we get into you know, Zavarsky stuff, it's like, this is really some cold-blooded stuff, which I guess that's war, but yeah, it's like, just like you said, they have these nice simple animation, not simple as in they're easy to make, but easily understood animations, right?
The analogies were good. There was one analogy we'll get into in more detail, I'm sure, but where they portray Nazi Germany as a wheel with all these spokes and like all the different ways that our strategies would try to attack them and how none of them would work. And they show that the spokes on the wheel like moving and getting thicker and it's contracting, expanding in resistance to all this stuff. And that's such a complex concept to sort of communicate. And just like the wheel and the spokes and the way they animated it and the way that everything worked was just amazing. Like, it was, you know, this is where Disney and I think a lot of animation can really shine in conveying really complicated concepts in just a few frames. Well, you know, thousands of frames, but to me and you, it's a few seconds.
Right. The other one I thought was quite effective because, you know, we don't, the layman doesn't think about this. The you know, the showing like you can have a 3 mile runway for land-based airplanes and then aircraft carriers, you basically can have puddle jumpers at best. Right. And that's why you can't just come in and let the planes rock, you know, I maybe now you can more because I guess they have smaller things with worse, you know, yield. Yeah. But
I learned a lot of new information, and then I say new, but this was 1942, right? So I'm at least, you know, a half a century or three quarters of a century behind on what I was learning. Like, oh wow, I didn't know we could do that. It's like, well, that's what like great grandpa could do.
There was kind of a World War One equivalent, although I think the movie might have come in, actually came out like right after the war, but Winsor McKay, the guy that did Gertie the Dinosaur, he did a sinking of the Lusitania film to, you know, kind of rile people up. But some of that had, you know, this battle animation, which I was like, oh, the people animating this, that must have been the reference point.
That's a deep conspiracy theory in itself, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The Lusitania.
Yeah. Of course. But this was the animator just like, OK, here's the thing. I want to light that on fire, the public consciousness version, because yeah, there's lots of weird stuff going around. Lusitania.
and I wanted to mention too that, like, though the infographic aspects of this movie were great, like, you know, beyond phenomenal, I can't commend them enough, but outside of some of like the goofier, they had like some very cartoony aspects of like planes flying around and people and like, you know, the planes like crashing constantly to kind of like show that air flight was unreliable at the very beginning. All of that animation is really cool. Then as they start getting into like the more advanced kind of like warplanes, all of a sudden it's like there's these little cutouts that they're using and they stop animating the planes and the planes aren't like moving through the air. It's just like a static image that someone's just kind of like, you know, adjusting slightly. And the only thing that gets animated is like some smoke or contrails coming out of it. And it was kind of jarring because it would go from something was like, oh wow, this is actually like an entertaining cartoon that's, you know, keeping me interested, to oh, I'm just kind of like looking at a static image that someone's kind of just like shifting around a little bit. I don't know if you picked up on that as much as me, but to me it was inconsistent. It was just like, you know, a bunch of different things kind of stitched together.
Yeah, I thought maybe we were going for like the war machine or something. I don't know.
Although I was also looking like whoever had this job probably was, you know, they could take way more coffee breaks than the guy that was like hand animating the plane, like rocking left and right. And, you know, like the people inside of it, like doing active things.
The other part of the history of this film is, you know, after the war, it was shelved because what's the point anymore, right? So, but that first, it's almost 30 minutes, isn't it? The history of animation segment was regularly played.
History of aviation.
Yeah. What did I say?
Animation.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is animation. Okay, that's why I said it. Okay, yes. History of aviation is that was shown on, you know, the Disneyland show in the 50s, shown on television regularly.
Yeah, I remember seeing that along with, you know, all the other classic cartoons and Saturday mornings or whatever it was.
But the lecture part, which does have some of the cool animation, like the wheel and all that you were mentioning, that was pretty much permanently shelved, to be honest. I know I was watching it on the On the Front Line DVDs that came out like 20 years ago now, but
okay, YouTube. That's what was so weird about this movie is, like, let's imagine that we went to the theater and you paid for the ticket and you went and sat down and you watched this thing. The type of person that really loves the initial part of the aviation and the cartoon aspect feels like a completely different person that would like that lecture part with the infographics, or at least it's like in two completely different mind states where it's like, I like goofy, silly, you know, cartoons that are going to make me kind of laugh a little bit versus, oh wow, like I'm watching like a documentary right now and they're just pumping information into me. It's weird that they're both in the same movie and it's considered like a cohesive movie.
That was probably RKO's long answer where I previously quoted the short.
The short one was, yeah, hell no.
One weird thing is how they're like enshrining General Billy Mitchell. I thought that was pretty weird because it's not like a household name. I mean, everyone still remembers General Patton, but they don't really remember General.
I mean, it's a very valid point though. I mean, I understand it and I kind of agree with giving him some credit here because it's because they even I made a note here because I hadn't heard about him either, but it was like, oh, poor whoever the hell they're talking about. Like everyone ignored him and they ridiculed him. Like they really like boo up this underdog, like, oh, this guy got, you know, kicked while he was down and no one wanted to listen to him. And then he ended up being right all along. It was almost like this underdog story that they were pitching. But yeah, the quote, it was like, poor General Billy Mitchell, he was ignored and ridiculed, you know, like that's how the movie kind of starts out. But my bias here, I was in the Air Force and I went through the brainwashing and the training and the mind control, but it was absolutely conveyed on us how crucial the air, you know, Air Force and just sort of like command of airspace in general is the foundation now of everything else. Like you can't have a Navy and you can't have an Army without having an Air Force. And in many cases, the Air Force can like eliminate the need to even bring in either of those other two guys. Like you might not even need ground forces if your Air Force is good enough. But this is like for someone in 1942, the Air Force didn't even exist, right? At that point, we just like had some planes. Like we had the Army Air Force, but we didn't have its own branch. And we were seeing how Britain had the Royal Air Force. Anyway, we'll get into that because it's kind of like in the real two of this.
Yeah. My note, by the way, for that was all General Billy Mitchell wanted was death from above.
Poor Bill. No one wanted to listen to him. They kept ridiculing him. I'll show you all.
What else did I write about the history of aviation? Let's see. Oh, yeah. I noticed one plane had, you know, like kind of a straight up hippie in it. I think when they were like testing the early planes, I was like, that guy's a hippie in 1942. That's pretty wild. He just had the, you know, the, I guess, 1972 George Carlin look or something.
and I don't know if you ever been to Kitty Hawk before by any chance.
I'm going to say no. It seems like it would have, but maybe I haven't.
I think I'm pretty sure I've been there before and I've probably have some Berenstain issues going on or like two memories might be melding together. I didn't look this up before here. But I believe there's an area right around there called Devil's Canyon, which had these like weird occult connotations to me. Even growing up, I remember thinking that was like such a weird thing that the origin of air flight and essentially, you know, like air warfare started in a place called Devil's Canyon, which is right by Kitty Hawk. I'm pretty sure I might just be making that up. And if I am, sorry. But I remember the Wright brothers kind of starting it all out. And that was... Disney makes it look like an absolute death trap every single time they animate anything that has to do with the Wright brothers or airplanes based on like that biplane or so like Wright brothers designs. Every single time it's animated in this movie, it's not something you would want to be anywhere near, right? It's not like they don't necessarily glorify those early days of aviation. If anything, they make it look like you know, you were lucky to survive even testing one of them.
It's like, you know, in modern film, we do that with astronauts when they're showing, especially the early stuff. It's like, yes, these guys are in tin cans strapping themselves to giant explosives, you know?
Yeah, it's a good analogy. Yeah.
So, yeah, this kind of had the same kind of vibe. I did notice that they worded it as an man's first modern flight, which I thought was actually kind of like forward thinking because they're like, hey, we don't know about what happened in the distant past. So,
yeah, well, maybe someone knew about the ancient aliens, right?
Yeah. So
the ancient astronauts.
But I did find it interesting. The wording was that as opposed to just like the first time man flew. It's like the first time man's flown in the modern era. So
they didn't want to offend the overlords that they knew about.
Yeah. You know, maybe in Comet they would fly around with their minds. I don't know, but well, there is the idea that, you know, using vibration to float the pyramid bricks into place, which I think is kind of cool. My favorite is where they had the plant and could that would soften stone and you would be able to shape the stone, you know, like concrete for a little while. So have you ever heard that theory?
A plant as in like a vegetative plant or a plant like a depot?
No, a plant is in like a vegetative plant, which you would let, you know, mash up, turn into like a goo, and you would be able to reshape the stones.
I've never heard that one. No, that one's fascinating to me.
Yeah, yeah, because I'm like, you know, something like that actually sounds somewhat reasonable. And I guess because I'm nuts, the idea that they knew how to vibrate them into place also sounds reasonable. So
that to me, that's honestly the one that I give the most credit to. If we're gonna pick from all of the outlandish examples, that one's the one that I gravitate towards is the vibrations. The vibrations, man.
Yeah. See, I don't like the alien one. I like to think it was, you know, something created here. So
no, I agree. Actually, we're getting on a tangent here, but I 100% agree. Like, I tend to like giving credit to ancestors and to like ancient technology that humans developed, rather than just like defaulting to some external force game. Because I really do think that we're capable of a lot more than we give ourselves credit for.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess we should get back to the movie.
I had a note here, and this felt like Disney making a point here, because there was a focus on the government contract. So after the early 1900s, they finally had like a first European flight, and that's when the concept of a plane went from just like a bunch of weirdos flying around in death traps in the sky out of novelty into, hey, there actually might be something to this if I can fly. You know, like transcontinental or things like this. So as soon as the government realized, hey, there might be something to these planes, the government just put out this contract, and they had this whole like a 3 to 5 minute animated segment about all of the different companies that submitted their plans for airplanes and how much they cost and what they were made out of. I just thought that was really interesting because they had one example that was like $10 million for a plane. And, you know, this is 1908, I believe, $10 million. One of them was like $450 per pound, but it didn't specify how many pounds the plane would be. And then ultimately it was the Wright brothers that got one of the three contracts picked, and the Wright brothers bid was $25,000, and the government decided to pay them for one airplane at the rate of $25,000. I don't know how specifically accurate that particular number was, but that was the one that they showed in the animation.
Yeah, no, I just wrote that I would have chosen the $10,000 bid that was on notebook paper. I thought that was like a nice balancing of everything. Yeah. One was on like a
they
napkin.
Didn't say the other two that got picked, so maybe that was that was one. Maybe they picked the $10 million one too, and they just don't talk about that because it was a flop.
Would you have flown one of these things in the 1900s? I mean, you didn't need a license or anything, so.
I feel like if I knew the Wright brothers and I saw them doing it a few times and not get hurt, I could have been convinced into doing it, but it wouldn't have been something that I saw and just like gravitated towards naturally. I'm not that much of a thrill seeker. No. What about you? Would you have done this?
I'm sitting here thinking probably along your lines. I don't want to be first, but you know. Yeah. but I did put, you know, nobody cares about Calbert and his 69 short hops anymore.
Yeah, it's funny how quickly like all of these huge advances just get completely forgotten. It's really interesting to see like how the Wright brothers technology, and I use that term I guess in very loose terms, but the technology was essentially they had the plane, and then they had the engine running, and then they had a pulley system where they basically just had like a literal rope or a cable essentially that held the plane back on a track so that it had enough time to kind of spin up the horsepower, I guess, and get the propeller going to where they had enough pull. And then they just kind of had a lever that would like release the pin that was like holding this plane back with like a little cable. And then it was able to just kind of like take off and I guess take flight for something like 12 seconds was the first big one. But just the concept of how, I guess, low tech that is compared to what we've got now is just sometimes it's just mind-blowing to consider the short amount of time between, you know, 1908 and 1940, you know, 40 years. And then if you want to keep extrapolating that from the 40s into like the mid 60s to going out to the moon, unless, you know, depending on what you believe. But man, what a crazy amount of leaps in technology between essentially 60 years from planes didn't even exist to now we're on the moon.
When I got up this morning, I saw something in the news for the near space luxury balloon. Have you seen this?
I haven't, but I understand what it is just by you describing it.
It's just, it's a space worthy capsule, but you know, doesn't actually go weightless because it only there's still air where it is. But they got like a bar and stuff on it. I'm like, that's hip. Space balloon looks fun.
I worked on a project called Spaceport America, which is in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And I believe they have another access point in place called Truth or Consequences. But as it was originally billed as kind of like a lame Disney World kind of thing, but it would be like where rich people, and I say rich, I think at the minimum they were pitching it like $200,000 to go to like suborbital kind of space, and you would call that like I went to outer space. But it was like $200,000 minimum a ticket. But the concept was that you can't run a business that only caters to people that spend $200,000. So then the other idea around it was that like the plebs, the middle class people could go and spend, you know, $60 or $70 on a ticket to go and like do little rides and little activities and then watch the rich people fly out into outer space and have them come back down and stuff. But it was kind of the same idea of like, you know, the uber wealthy to have some money to burn, just go out and get as close to space as you can, just because what else are you using your money for? You know, stocks.
So they're basically building Westworld.
Almost. I mean, I get that AI is probably going to be there eventually, right?
Although I'm still in this idiotic situation where I've seen the 70s movie, but not the TV show. So, but I've heard about the TV show. So I got a few hits from that, I guess.
Well, let me know when you go through. Maybe we can do another podcast out of that one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Is that one of the one that like eats it in the later seasons, though, or something? I think I heard that.
Yeah. I think it jumps the shark a little bit in season two. I think what a little tangent here, but this is actually a really interesting note, is that Westworld TV show is in a weird example of where the writers were paying attention to the internet too much, and they saw that the internet was kind of solving the like Easter eggs and the riddles that they were kind of setting up in season one in real time. And the writers were trying to get ahead of it by like outsmarting the internet and trying to like subvert expectations. And they did that in such a weird way towards the end of season one. And they just like went full force in season two, to the point where they were just like constantly trying to like make sure the internet couldn't guess their next move. So it turned into like this weird thing where it was like, you're not watching a TV show that someone sat down and wrote for a full, like, you know, a storyline to get you engrossed in. They were just trying to outsmart you the whole time and make you feel like you were dumb, which turns out people don't love feeling like they're idiots. You know what I mean? So anyways, it kind of jumped the shark for season two, season three, loss of bearing, and then a lot of people like four. But season one is 1,000,000% worth watching season one, even if you don't like the rest of them.
Yeah, I've heard that one's quite sad. Yeah, I guess the first shows that really fell prey to that, let's call it hubris, would probably be Lost and Battlestar, because I was following both of those and people totally did guess what their plan was for both shows. So
You watch Lost as it aired, or did you watch it years later?
I watched both of them as they aired.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, Lost was groundbreaking, though, because I think it was also one of the very first primetime TV shows in history in American pop culture that showed subtitles in so many different languages and sort of these like vignette style shots. Like, that wasn't really seen outside of kind of like artsy, you know, things that you wouldn't see on primetime on one of the major networks.
Yeah, because both shows, they had their finales within about a month of each other. And I remember at the time, like, in both were, you know, underwhelming in different ways and good in different ways too. I'm not going to poop on either of those shows too much in the end, but at the time I was like, well, I guess Lost stuck the landing better. And, you know, 12 years later, I'm like, no, Battlestar easily aged better.
was that a pun, that Lost stuck the landing better?
Oh, yeah. Well, it didn't in the end, did it?
No, it didn't.
But I've rewatched Battlestar like twice since it was on air. I have not had the attention span to do Lost again. So got it on my shelf. I can do it when I want. But one age better than the other. Anything else on the history of aviation segment you want to hit on before we
No, I kind of separated my notes into the reels, because there was three, at least the video that I watched, they had like three different reels with like little intermissions between. Did yours have that too or no?
No, all I got was the Leonard Maltin intro that looked like it was filmed on tissue paper. Okay. It was like 90s video.
So mine was actually categorized military footage, and it was labeled, 342 USAF 38105, and then it was reel one, reel two, reel three, where it literally like would just stop in the middle of an animation and it would spin up a new reel two or something. So it was like a military archive dump, I guess, somewhere.
Yeah, I mean,
which was like interesting.
I said, I think this making this movie seemed to have been, well, at least Disney ran with the ball. If someone else told him to do it, he was the guy. He made this kind of his personal project a little more than the other movies. So, but I could see like, yeah, let's show it to the troops and stuff.
That was all my notes. It was just interesting that between up until 1914, essentially before World War One, that planes were truly just seen as like a novelty. Like there was no practical purpose for it. It was just like, what are those idiots freaking doing out there on that cliff? Like, you know,
I love when they do start showing air warfare though, where the guy's just in the back like throwing bombs out, you know, with his hand. I was like, yeah, I guess you would do that at first.
Yeah, that was so cool too, because it's like it's a cartoon and this is done in that cartoony style with like, you know, emphasized kind of like loose positions. It wasn't necessarily like rotoscoped at this point. Later on you get some like rotoscoping, but this one was like true character animation, you know, cartoon style. But it was like, you know, pulling out a gun and just shooting at another guy in a plane, and then, you know, pulling out like grenades and just dropping them out of the sky. But sure enough, that's exactly how all of that started. I thought that was kind of cool, because I'd never really considered that concept as much, that at some point there was literally just two dudes flying planes around each other, like shooting at each other with pistols or rifles or something. They mentioned shotguns. I don't know how accurate all that was, but they mentioned that they used to just shoot shotguns out in the air as they were driving or flying.
I'd hate to be the guy that was the guy that figured out you can't shoot your machine gun through non-technologically enhanced propellers.
It's a cool invention. It was a real, and it mentioned something that I guess by 1940 they were able to shoot like 9,000 rounds a minute. It might have been even more than that. I thought that was pretty impressive, though.
Yeah. Horrible, but impressive. Impressively horrible. Oh, no, I was just like, I'd throw fish from my airplane, and then I'd be a fisher. So, yeah. I was thinking of the guy from The Muppets, you know, with a, like, throw the fish around. and then as we move into the present of 1942, that's where, again, I'm like, I guess Zaversky's some kind of a war criminal here. I don't know. there was a lot about like they're getting this book author to give this basically a lecture, as you said, Nate. The director, what else did he do? I don't remember, but they made sure to get like a serious director on this to make it more interesting. If you notice, he's moving around a lot. There's a lot of, you know, moving shots. So
they try. It didn't work for me, but I could see that they were trying.
They were definitely trying.
At one point he's like moving slides around and like, oh, let's walk over here. And then he like goes in front of like a big globe. And then he's like pointing at stuff on the globe. And then he like walks a little bit further and something's projecting behind him. So like, yeah, they put more care into it. So it wasn't just a dude in front of a screen yelling at you.
Yeah, again, you know, and this is a case where the studio suits at RKO may have not been wrong, right?
but
that's, I mean, this was not, you know, this tries its hardest to be an entertaining film, but yeah, it's clearly not. It's an educational film, right? So or a mind manipulation film, if you want to go propaganda film, if you want to take that route. So
I think without question it's a propaganda film in some ways, although this probably is heavier on like really interesting strategy. Like they're literally showing you like, here's the proposed strategies and how they need to work, and I guess the ultimate, we didn't really cover when we first started talking about like what was the ultimate purpose of the film. And it's obviously to just sell whoever's watching it on a few things. One is that we need our own air force. The United States needs its own air force. That's one of the big ones. And the other one was like, and get ready for what that means, which essentially they mentioned was like 100 million tons of raw materials like every week or something. Like it was some insane amount, but it was basically like, everyone get ready to, you know, give up all of your luxury goods and your car manufacturing and just anything that you're used to, and just put it all towards this war machine so that we can amass the largest arsenal of the most, you know, variety of different weapons, specifically air, but you know, everything. That was like the movie was selling the general public essentially on like, get ready to, you know, stop seeing metal everywhere because metal's all going to be turning into these airplanes.
Yeah, that was another effective animation where you're seeing the pulsing industrial heart of the United States, which is quite dystopian looking to the modern eye, you know, pumping out its arteries of bottleneck,
pumping out shipping. Warships. Yeah. And I thought it was the cool, I mean, maybe intentional, but they had literal ships and bottles coming out, and they were trying to show that the ports were the bottlenecks of everything. So it was a very literal image of like a ship getting like squeezed out through a small little bottleneck, kind of slowing everything down. But I just thought that was cool. You know, bottleneck is literal, but then also a ship in a bottle. Like what a cool sort of like compound symbol that was.
But yeah, that does make you, I mean, you know, like how many people really think about, how many people outside of military strategy and planning actually think about, you know, maintaining supply lines, you know, because to someone that's sitting around the room like I am now, I just move that over there, man. Yeah.
Well, but, you say that now. I mean, in 1942, probably almost nobody, right? Except for like serial killers and military generals. But now in, you know, 2022, anyone that likes playing Sim, you know, or Civilization or any kind of real-time strategy game, like I think I made a note here, like how cool would it be to have a Disney animated sort of like real-time sim, like war sim game, you know, like Cuphead meets Civilization.
I'm sitting here wondering if something like that even exists. I still haven't wrapped my head around Kingdom Hearts. So I have a friend that just started doing Kingdom Hearts, which is just a bizarre mixture of kind of, if you don't know, it's the anime. And
no, I actually loved it. I played the first one when it came out and I fell in love with it.
Okay. I'm a weirdo where I only played like the DS one. So that's, and it was like the weird broken version of the original game, I think.
Well, the original one is very hard to go back and revisit now. It's just things have come such a long way in terms of game design since that one came out. But at the time when it came out, you know, combining the IP of Disney and Final Fantasy was just, you know, it was like they couldn't have come out with like such a more unpredictable yet well-working sort of synergy, I think.
Right. Getting back to the lecture, that sounds so like so buzzkilly. Let's get back to the lecture.
It was absolutely a lecture. The dude even had like a pointing stick and was like pointing on things, and again, like walking over to a globe. Like I felt like it was a sort of a bore. Again, like, you know, I went through military training in the Air Force, and I've been through like the actual lectures of some dude describing military strategy, and I just remember thinking, man, I wish that all of those lectures I had been in at least came with like some Disney animation to go behind it. And again, this is like 2001, so they obviously had the footage and the know-how to make some good animation, but no, we just got really, really boring stuff.
Oh, here's my note. The director may have helped him sound good, but he still sounds like a cold-blooded murderer. And then I liked, it's sometime when he's saying like particularly like kind of cold-blooded stuff, and they have like a picture of a lady in the background, I guess, to gain some subconscious support for him as he's talking about, you know, offing lots of people. There's this, I don't know if you know this, he's saying something just over his left shoulder, is like a smiling black and white photo of his wife or daughter or something.
I know, I absolutely love just like how casual he would mention one of the exact quotes, or this is a little bit paraphrased, but he mentions as he's going through this, and he just casually says, and you know, we must produce the most amount of weapons of a vast variety. And it was just all about, and like, and then showing, there was an example where they blow up a dam and they're trying to take out the power grid for either Germany or Japan or whoever they're, you know, describing about attacking, and you see this water flood out across the city. And I'm just thinking, like, that's not very precise. You know what I mean? Like, that's pretty much anyone at all that lived in that downtown is now underwater immediately. But they're not even talking about that. They're just talking about knocking out the power to the rest of the country. So there was a very weird juxtaposition of, like, wait a minute, like, 5 minutes ago, I was literally watching a cartoon dude, like, you know, shooting like a pistol out of a plane, which I guess also was a little bit dark, but it was cartoony. And now we're talking about drowning an entire, you know, city of people here through like legit military tactics.
They have no Superman to save them in that case. But yeah, they just kind of pan away from that rushing water. So let's see what's going on with the power. Oh yeah, I thought some of the battle footage when they were showing Dunkirk, it started making me thinking a little bit of, speaking of Superman, some of the Fleischer animation for Superman. I guess Disney had poached a few of those guys by this point. So,
oh yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I could totally see some of that style, and that might be part of that juxtaposition I was mentioning before of like two completely different animation styles.
Yeah, yeah. I was wondering if the modern equivalent of this movie in general might be like, you know, victory through cyber war or something, you know? I mean, someone showing how routers work and, you know, IPs or something, and doing it like it sounds dry as hell, which I guess this movie is too, but at least there's, you know, some compelling visuals to help you understand it. So
how do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
I would love to see a version of this movie where they replay the strategy of what actually happened, not what they were kind of proposing to have happened.
Well, you could say that we kind of cheated.
You know, how so?
Because
oh, yeah.
This movie, you know, does not assume that we will be having, you know, dropping nukes on anyone in a few years.
Yeah, no, actually I've got some notes on that we'll bring up. Actually, you know, I guess we're getting there right now.
Yeah, sure, you want to do that, because yeah, I was like,
well, so a couple of my notes, because again, I'm wearing like the reels, so like in reel two, which is right before we actually talk about how we were going to go after Japan and Germany and everything, but in reel two my notes were some interesting takeaways was, first of all, that airfare was unique in a few different ways, air warfare rather. First, that once the government started investing in all of these planes, those planes could also double during peacetime and be used to deliver mail, to deliver supplies. And it's pretty much, up until that point, was the only example of this massive investment that the government made in vehicles that had any sort of use during peacetime. Like ships, maybe a little bit. Tanks definitely didn't really have any sort of use during peacetime, right? Like they just kind of sit there and collect dust and require maintenance. But planes have of like almost, you know, just as much, maybe even more use in peacetime for commercial and just kind of infrastructure reasons. So that was interesting. And then also, just to like overly stress this again, this was beaten to my head in military training, but how absolutely unique it is that the invention of the plane, especially for military purposes, just completely invalidated the Navy and the Army ground forces in a big way. I mean, it's not like, you know, having a Navy and Army land forces like don't matter anymore, but like a plane just flies right over them. You know what I mean? Like they're no longer blockers for you to get into a country, and you no longer have to rely on the Navy to create blockades and kind of starve resources out of a country. You just send a plane over there and drop a bomb and like you're in and out. As we kind of see as the ultimate evolution of all of this, but it's such an important thing to not undersell how absolutely revolutionary that concept is of like all of a sudden this plane just changed warfare forever. Like even to this day, I believe, like, I guess you can make an argument now for like information warfare and cyber warfare, but really it's whoever has the best airfare and who can control the airspace that kind of wins wars now, you know?
Yeah, because when I was growing up, my dad was, you know, making ship models of various kinds. And as a kid, I was like, why don't they make battleships anymore? They look so cool and they're fun to build models of. Well, here's why.
Well, and the biggest battleships are really just like aircraft carriers just holding planes to get them in better position for, you know, the air control. So
what exactly is the point of a destroyer? Because we still have plenty of those.
Well, I mean, this movie makes a really good point here in that the point is that if everyone has equal technology, if we've got the same air technology and Navy technology and sort of like infantry, then it just becomes a battle of like who has the most of the stuff. You know what I mean? Like if me and you are at war and we can both produce the exact same type of ship, then it's just like if I can make mine bigger with more weapons on them and make more of them, then I just kind of win in a general strategic aspect of, you know, might versus might. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the large aspect of like, why do we still keep producing this? It's just because you don't want to fall behind and like another country now has more than you do.
I'm not quite sure where Reel 2 ends and Reel 3 starts, but I did. There was about a minute where I was like, someone was like giggling writing the script or something, because I just started writing verbatim things he was saying through about a minute, which I got rim job with machines, steel against steel with enough force.
we're in Reel 3 here. Yeah, we're in okay. Reel 3 now.
I was like, didn't that kind of sound a little like that in 1942 as well? I don't know.
I don't think so. Maybe at least not to these military guys. I don't think that they were making jokes when they made this. Maybe the animators or the script writer was and was like, let's see what we can get this guy to say. Let's get him to say rim job.
yeah. You know, it's kind of like Ron Burgundy or something. I don't know.
that quote was actually from, I think, my favorite part of the movie, which is weird because it was just like an infographic. But again, it was specifically showing how the difference was that the Allies essentially had to rely on these external forces and these long, you know, supply routes that had to like meander around countries and kind of like avoid things, and just the vast amount of resources it took and how much risk, like, for example, to get tanks over to Germany or even to Japan, you would have had to send them all on a big ship, and the German U-boats could just sit with one direct hit. They could sink an entire ship. And if that ship had tanks on it, now you just lost tanks and a ship and the people and all the time that it took to get it that far and to manufacture it. And the list goes on. So it was interesting to kind of to see the aspect of the German force. And then they described the Axis as being all internal. They didn't have to go outside the country, and they had very quick supply lines where if the exact part you're mentioning where it's like, you know, steel on steel and metal on metal. And it was showing these like arrows kind of like hammering towards the inside of the German war machine, which was the center of this wheel with the spokes. And every time like one of these big arrows, which kind of represented, I guess, like ground support, you know, ground forces trying to attack Germany, it would just show how Germany could just immediately respond by ramping up production and sending it to wherever they were being attacked. Anyway, that was such an impressive infographic, because again, they were conveying a very complicated aspect in such an easy, like, I feel like a child could kind of be watching it and understand at least what the visuals were portraying.
I guess this movie in the end is kind of like indirect lobbying. Like, you don't go into the senator's office. You're just, you make this film.
I mean, you could make a very strong argument because the CIA gets to play consultant in all sorts of military government related movies. Oh, yeah. Right. So, I mean, how is that any different as trying to garner favor with the public, you know, Hollywood audience, essentially of like training you on, you know, training on you and like what to expect to see, but also gauging public reaction, just like a product goes to market and they have a test audience. Here's a good way that, you know, the CIA or the war machine can kind of like get a test audience going, like, oh, you guys like the American Sniper. Okay. Duly noted. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Here's Maverick for you.
Yeah, exactly. The Top Gun 2 comes out. Bam. Let's see what kind of a general reception we get. Oh, you guys love it? All right, we're going to war.
But I feel like it's taking a little lesson in the past. Like, you know, they 2 years ago, it seemed like the plot really was like, oh, we're going to war with Iran now. And everyone was like, no, the drone people, you know, so
it didn't. Yeah, that one didn't pass the public relations test, you know.
Right. Ukraine's still up for grabs. So literally in public relations, because it's not really clear what's going on. Then we're just getting the news. So what's going on? Don't know. But yeah, let's see. Oh yeah, Air Command. We get the air. Oh, sorry, I was looking. I skipped a few things there.
Well, I had a question that I wanted to pose to you, and I guess anyone listening, just as a thought experiment. But they're mentioning this aspect of how America is going to have to like tighten their belts and get used to this loss of things that you're used to, so that all these resources can go to the war machine. Now, imagine in 2022, the government comes out and they're like, "All right, everyone, you know, tighten your belts, because we're going to need all of the microchips, all the metal, all the plastics, the rubber, just everything needs to all go to the war machine." It feels like a completely different society that would accept that now. Like that same society would be like, you know what? That's right. I'll do my part. You know, I'll forgo. I'll just eat, you know, rice and kind of go to like a ration system, you know, whether it's quasi. I feel like it would be such a harder sell today with all the modern luxuries and sort of, you know, people set in ways. It would not be received the same.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't think I've ever had anything rationed. Otherwise, you know, you can't buy more than five, you know, or something like that. But that's usually a sale, right? That's not rationing. Yeah. So we're not used to that sort of thing. But yeah, it's just weird. It's, oh, the bomb's forever growing in size. I'm like, that's not a good thing. Dr. Seuss told us that. But yeah, just he gets so excited about that sort of thing. It's like, no, that's not good. That's what we want to avoid. But I don't know. I guess in the middle of World War II, it sounds okay, does it? I don't know.
Yeah, well, they mentioned that we started with like bombs that were being, you know, bombs and grenades that were literally being dropped by a person that were around 25 pounds at their biggest, to in, you know, 1942 when they were airing this, mentioning like 10 plus ton bombs. And again, in retrospect, knowing that they had been, you know, the Manhattan Project and had been developing the atomic bomb, like this 10 ton bombs they were talking about being like the latest and greatest, that had nothing at all on the reality.
Yeah. Although you look at something like Dresden, and the conventional bombs did quite well creating havoc and destruction. So.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It wasn't the same game. It was not the same as the 10 ton bomb that they were talking about in this movie, though, is what I was getting at.
Oh yeah. I thought the map at the end was quite weird looking. They had like Europe and Russia at the top, and the Arctic was kind of not quite in the center. And I think they were trying to show supply lines, but I was just like, that's a bizarre map.
Yeah, they were trying to emphasize in the point on how hard it was to get around certain areas and how to traverse the different countries, depending on if it was wartime or peacetime. Because there was a good example of like during peacetime, to get from Alaska to like Australia or something. I'm probably butchering some of that, but like to get that from Alaska to Australia, it was like 4,000 miles or 6,000 miles. But during a time of war, it was like double that, because of how you had to kind of like navigate around enemy territory. And that this aspect you could extrapolate to like anywhere you wanted to get in the world, all of a sudden would take you 2 to 3 times as long to get there, just because you have to like, you know, tread around dangerous areas again.
I thought they did do a pretty good job of showing, though, you know, why the Arctic is kind of important, because we've had, I think it's the past 10 years, Russia's been like really getting serious about their Arctic bases, and no one's been paying that much attention.
Oh, that's because it's the entrance to Hollow Earth, man. You gotta protect the entrance to Hollow Earth.
Oh, yeah, that. Because Godzilla versus Kong put in the Antarctic, didn't they? They're just trying to throw you off.
Well, that's just like the you know, the exit off the north ramp and the exit off the south ramp. That's all that is.
All the Admiral Byrd stuff. The thing with him is it's confusing, because he had to run in the north and the south. So it's sometimes you got to get those two stories straight and then work out what actually happened with those two stories as well.
That's a very popular topic in the conspiracy world, for sure.
Oh yeah, I did a Operation High Jump episode about a year ago. So yeah, it's like, yeah, I want to talk about that. But
what an awesome! That's one of my favorite topics.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, that's a little after this vintage, I guess. But yeah, because you mentioned paperclip when we were getting this one ready.
Oh yeah. How crazy it is that we haven't brought that up yet. That's like that's the core aspect of this.
Well, I was about to say we haven't brought it up yet because it hadn't quite happened yet when this came out.
Well, yeah, good point. But I guess I don't know how many other Disney movies that we're going to talk about that deal with World War II and Nazi warfare and Disney specifically, because uniquely Operation Paperclip involved grabbing these Nazi scientists essentially after the war was over, or as it was becoming over. We didn't want anyone else to get a hold of the Nazi scientists, so we wanted to get them for ourselves before Russia got them or anyone else. So we bring them all over here, and then to help sort of sell the concept that we now have literal Nazi, you know, party members, high-ranking military Nazis now in the United States, claiming government benefits, living in your neighborhood. Part of that was having Disney, you know, sort of sell them. You got Wernher von Braun on a bunch of Disney series, and I forgot the Heinz Haber, I believe, was the other one. They both almost became sort of household names for children watching how we were going to start going to the moon. And that very much, in my mind at least, was very much part of Operation Paperclip. You know, it wasn't just get them over here. It was also, and make sure that we kind of like, you know, revamp their image a little bit, give them a little nice little makeover. Oh, now Walt Disney's over here. Oh, if he's friends with Walt, then, you know, these are good guys. Don't mind the death gold skull, you know, honor that he was given by Hitler directly. No, he's a good guy now.
Yeah, we should probably hit one of those 50. Sometimes I was trying to figure out the name because I know it's not Your Friend the Atom, but one of the other ones. But yeah, the Tomorrowland disc, I know it's on there, but they do not print the titles of the actual contents on the discs. So but yeah, because yeah, making Wernher von Braun and Disney, you know, being your kindly, you know, old uncles, right? So Uncle Walt and Werner telling you to go to space.
and it is kind of surreal again, because I was watching the Epcot video, seeing how Walt was like trying to make this utopian society that had no retirees or homeless people or like essentially sick. Like, you know, if there was anything wrong with you, you were not allowed to live in this literal bubble of a city. And then also this like warfare promotion. And then also considering how he literally resold the public on Wernher von Braun and a whole bunch of other Operation Paperclip Nazis that came here. What an interesting thing, because again, he was like representative of this like wholesome, family friendly, like it's all just like fairy tales and happy thoughts. But really, man, this guy was, you know, behind the greatest war machine in all of history, or modern history at least.
Well, 1942 is right after Disney had come off of, you know, having several years of labor troubles and legal problems, right? So like when Snow White came out, it was, you know, they were working too hard, which is why they had the labor disputes. But it was, the atmosphere was still a little more, I guess, family like at the studio, whereas by this point it had grown a lot. They'd had all the labor issues, you know. Watt probably had lost a fair amount.
Walt's just like, kill them all.
Well, he used to dress pretty quirky, and about this time is when we just get, you know, Walt in gray suits all the time. So,
you know, all the photos are just him surrounded by yes men that all look like super involved in whatever he's doing, holding up a map or like pointing at something. He's got like 12 people that are like, yeah, Walt, that's interesting. Or like, yeah, Walt, what a great idea.
Because there's photos from the creation of Disneyland where I guess he was in a good mood and kind of reverted back to his old style, like temporarily, of wearing kind of like absurdist clothing. But yeah, generally from 1942 on, it's like, okay, I'm going to be businessman Walt, and on TV Uncle Walt, but you know, with the look of business.
Yeah, don't mind Uncle Walt. He's just over here starting a war.
Yeah, really. We're telling you how to do the war. Yeah, because they show several strategies that won't work. One of them being the island hopping strategy, which is pretty much what they went with until, you know, until the A-bomb. So
But yeah, we do have what all those, you know, ridiculously bloody battles from the island hopping. So I guess he was not wrong that that was not really a great approach. Because what we do,
it was interesting showing the strategies there, because it's almost like, is Walt Disney telling me what the strategy is, or was this the like all military strategy being portrayed out into the public, and how much of this, like how much of that infographic part was Walt involved in, or did he just hand the reins to the animation department over to like a general somewhere?
I would assume that Seversky described it in his book and they were just trying. So then there, you know, you're taking some liberty simply by animating it, but I guess his stamp of approval's on the film since he's in it giving a lecture.
It would have been so much cooler if it was like Uncle Walt describing these military strat, and here's how we're going to hit the Japs from this angle. And you know,
I guess even he had enough enough to realize that he was probably the wrong man to be doing this. Well, folks, you know, we're going to just it would have worked.
It might have made it more entertaining to watch. But yeah, I guess I can understand with the decision there.
Yeah, it would have been more entertaining that way. But of course, this, again, this guy was not a speaker. They were trying to direct the hell out of him to make it like mildly watchable.
And I have a note here, too, that you know, Illuminati confirmed they showed the Freemasonic compass right in the middle of Japan and like showing the it was basically like a radius of either how we could get to them or the amount of protection that they had. But it straight up just had like a compass turning around like in a little circle. I thought that was interesting.
I think that actually did catch my eye. Yeah. Well, I guess it was supposed to catch your eye. There were a couple images near the end that struck me as weird other than the map. They have that totem pole on screen for like 5 seconds as the planes fly off.
I noticed that too because I was expecting that like German Byzantine style eagle almost, but it was like a totem for some reason. I didn't understand that.
And then they have,
because was that from Germany or was that from like Alaska maybe, or like the Pacific Islands?
I was thinking Pacific Northwest. Like I felt okay. Like they're in my mind, they're like flying out of Seattle or something.
Well, it would have been. Well, yeah, I don't know. It's a good point because in this movie, they do not talk about the atomic bomb. They're talking about how they might leverage an attack on Japan from perhaps the Pacific Islands or even from like Alaska was one of the examples. But the way that we actually did it was from the Northern Mariana Islands. And that's where the actual plane that was carrying the atomic bomb left from, which right. Ironically, I think the main island there is called Pagan, which I just thought was an interesting little side note.
And then they have, you mentioned the eagle or whatever, they have the eagle versus the octopus. And I was like, that has some stuff. I mean, you know, octopus and a serpent are different, but it made me think of the whole eagle versus serpent vibe.
Well, and the octopus of like global control and, you know, many, many government, specifically military industrial complex government conspiracy theories tend to lean towards this octopus symbolism.
Yeah. And I guess in this case, they're calling the Axis the octopus, which now we would call people like Disney more like, you know, the industrialists as being having a few more tentacles, I guess. I don't know. But yeah. Too much extraterrestrial DNA. That's the problem with the octopus.
And I looked at this. I went on a little bit of a tangent, but I was interested again because they didn't go into the atomic bomb. But I was on a tangent on like, where did the actual plane set off from? And, you know, what was the plane's name and everything? And it was called the plane was called the Enola Gay, which was a B-29 bomber. And it was called the Enola Gay because the pilot named it after his mom. So the bombs that, you know, the plane that dropped these atomic bombs, Hiroshima Nagasaki, was in a plane named after the pilot's mother, Enola Gay Tibbetts. And he was quoted as describing this, and he said, "My thoughts turned at this point to my courageous red-haired mother, whose quiet confidence had been a source of strength to me beyond or since boyhood and career to become a military pilot. And at a time when dad had thought I had lost my marbles, she taken me aside and said, 'You know, it'll be all right, son.'" So this like experience had him name the plane after his mom, which then basically ended at least our fight with Japan at that point. I mean, we dropped the atomic bomb. And I was going to ask you, I mean, you live in Japan. So like, what is the actual like history there? Like, can you go to school and children learn about, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Like, what is the general reaction and how is there not just immediate disdain towards the United States based on that one event?
Right. I will answer that, of course. But I was also thinking of Armageddon, where the guy at the beginning is like, you know, name the planet killing asteroid after my wife.
Yeah, that's a good
point. So that was the first thing that
came to mind. Maybe this was like more of a, like, I guess I read the quote as like he named it after his mom out of like good intentions, but maybe this was like my fiery redheaded, you know, bitch of a mom.
Right. In Japan, like, of course, I didn't go to school in Japan, but, you know, you'll regularly see the Hiroshima Peace Dome as sort of a big tourist attraction. So I do teach junior high classes and we have the junior high textbooks on hand. And one of the essays is the story of Sadako, which is some girl that was on the outskirts of one of the explosions. And, you know, dies horribly of cancer like 10 years later. So, but that's the point that the focus, I guess, isn't so much on the, I mean, you know, the people that died instantly, that's horrible. But the textbook was really focusing on those lingering effects, I guess. But it didn't, I don't even know if it mentioned. All right, my mic went out there. I don't even think it mentioned America. I just think I was there for the bomb. It went off. You know, she got irradiated, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, just, I mean, out of my own ignorance, but it's watching this movie, it was like every once in a while, I had this thought of like, oh, yeah, Japan was kind of the enemy during World War II. Like, it's so easy to forget. And even like Pearl Harbor within the context, but it doesn't. It's, again, this is my own ignorance, maybe this might be unique to me, but when World War II comes up, I think Germany, Nazis, Hitler, very rarely does my mind immediately go to like, oh yeah, Japan and Pearl Harbor. It's almost like, I don't know, like maybe just because Japan was like a smaller aspect of it, but I don't know, that it just kept grabbing by surprise in this movie of like, oh yeah, that's right, Japan was part of this. And I guess we're on good, you know, everyone's on good relations now, Japan, Germany, and the United States. Ironically, more so than China and Russia, which are kind of being pitched as like America's sort of allies in this. It's so weird. It's a very abstract sort of just like concept to wrap your head around.
The other things that happened, you know, at the end of the war was the emperor came out and made a speech and people had never heard his voice before, you know, sort of like,
did he sound like this?
he was a mouse. But yeah, you know, he made a speech and was like, yeah, kind of separating himself from the generals, right? Because he did stay emperor for another 20, 30 years, something like that. So
yeah, they didn't have a Magna Carta.
right. Well, we still have emperors. The big controversy a few years ago is the emperor just wanted to quit. He didn't die.
is there a version of Magna Carta there? Where essentially Magna Carta just said like the king and the court were not above the law and that they were subject to the same laws they impose on everyone else. Does that exist within emperors as well?
The only thing that really happened, this was the point of him speaking to Japanese people directly, is the emperor is not a god. But the emperors of Japan have not actually wielded power for probably like 1,000 years.
Like a Buckingham Palace kind of situation.
But it's been doing that for like 1,000 years. That's one of the reasons it's probably the longest running, you know, line of, I mean, they probably fudged it somewhere and just didn't tell us, but you know, the line that they say it's the family line's been unbroken for like, you know, a millennia and a half or something, right?
Well, but you would say that.
Right. No, I know.
You know, you're not gonna be like, you know, been in business since 1987. Like, that doesn't have the same ring to it.
Right. But I'm like, yeah, they might, you know, might have tweaked that line somewhere and we just don't know about it. But yeah, it's been almost 1,000 years since the emperor really had any real power. But so, you know, the war was the generals and there's some people in the government just like, let's, you know, war hawks, like literally, right? And so they were, of course, kind of taken out or at the end of the war or whatever, but the emperor remained, and MacArthur was in charge of Japan for a while, and the Japanese seemed to really like him, so maybe that's where relations improved. I'm still pissed at MacArthur because he made weed illegal in Japan, and it still is, but you get in a drugstore before that.
Really? Single-handedly, he just decided that, like, screw these guys and their weed.
Yeah,
hippies.
That's right. Because you know, there's like 10 years after Reefer Madness, right? So, but yeah, that's. But anyway, in general, I guess the Japanese were kind of happy with MacArthur's administration for about 5 years. I think it took 5 years before they let the Japanese sort of like have their own proper, you know, be autonomous again. The same thing with Germany, right?
Well, yeah, it's interesting what happens like after a huge nation loses a war. It's like. Like on a global scale, the equivalent of like, you know, two friends getting into like a big fight in like a big popular party in front of everybody. Like one of them has to, you know, like has to like make their way back to the bathroom and clean up and then like be seen at school and work the next day and kind of like live that off. And again, I guess this is another example where Japan and Germany kind of differ to where like Germany. Is still sort of I want to say butt of a joke, but I don't have a better phrase. I'm saying this, but like they still are seen as like, or even their media, right? Like they're not allowed to show a lot of that old kind of Nazi symbolism almost as part of law. I think like, I know as certain games and books can't be published in the country of Germany, if it's got a swastika in it, unless it's in very specific context. So like that wound is obviously still very open and, you know, like very sensitive versus I don't think America has maybe strayed away from developing nuclear arsenal. You know what I mean? Like the outcome of that, if anything, kind of reconfirmed their war machine decision that bigger and better and vast variety is what you want to win wars. So they walked away from that, learning a very scary lesson, I think.
The other thing is when Japan did start become autonomous again, they had their pacifist constitution, which we still have today, but they've been, you know, trying like hell to change it for the past 10 years.
is that just like complete, not just non-interventionist, but like anti-war period?
Yeah. Japan doesn't have a military. We have the SDF, the self-defense force, meaning it's only meant to defend self. But like a few years ago, they pulled some strings where they could actually like engage a little bit, a few troops, not many Japanese troops, but I think a few actually engaged in the Middle East. And they have been trying to change the constitution, which most Japanese are not really for. They, you know, they like having a constitution that says we don't fight people. But and that's where America has also been important, because America has been the shield, right? That's they have. The somewhat controversial military bases in Okinawa, and you know, we have like a defense treaty with America, so we're kind of relying. That was why Trump was like, "You guys need to pay us more."
Yeah, I was going to say that they need to pay. They need to pay.
But yeah, Japan is relying on America's defense shield. But I guess they're
to be fair, I think strategically, there's way more advantage. For, you know, for America or for anyone to have bases in Japan because of where it's located and kind of isolated versus some of the other places that they need to pay. I think a lot of that was like European NATO and, you know, sort of areas where they the strategy of having America maybe not be as strong as right there in Japan.
But yeah, I hopefully that gives you a nice rundown of the situation in Japan. But yeah, they got over getting bombed. I guess they kind of felt like it was kind of their fault for being at war. You know, kind of
and I don't even want to unwrap this whole other onion of a conspiracy theory of Pearl Harbor, and that a very popular theory that I could be easily sold on in the right context and maybe after a drink or so, but that Pearl Harbor was absolutely allowed to happen and that it could have been easily prevented. Therefore, making it so that this atomic reaction to, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki might have never happened if they could have just easily prevented Pearl Harbor, because Japan would not have been seen as such a strong aggressor. But once that happened, it allowed us to escalate on our side and kind of deliver that final, like, oh shit, they're not, you know, oh they're not messing around anymore.
Well, I don't even think it's a conspiracy theory anymore that Roosevelt definitely knew like a few days prior. Did he know like a few months prior? I guess that would be, because that would suggest a lot
or
more.
Or if there was a literal stand down order to, you know, like the information was out there, but like it was like, let them bomb so that we finally have a reason to get into this, you know, war. Because yeah, that was essentially what transitioned us from being non-interventionist into like, okay, we're in this now, rolling up our sleeves.
Yeah. So I think at least a little bit of knowing beforehand is generally considered to be like, you know, like legit history now. But yeah, you could, there's definitely, you could look deeper.
Japan got played by somebody, right? Or maybe both, because they essentially were acting on behalf of the Axis by even doing the bombing. But we kind of like left the door open and like knew there, you know, it's like the redneck with the itchy trigger finger that kind of like wants the neighbor to wander in and like break into their house in the middle of the night, because now they've got a reason to like use that nice shiny shotgun that they've been dreaming about, you know, shooting for so long.
Well, keep in mind, you know, Japan had been completely closed for what, almost 200 years when the American Navy rolled in and said, no, you can't do that anymore. You need to join the modern world, which Japan maybe did too good a job of, because in around 1905 or so, they went and trounced the Russian Navy in the Sino-Japanese War, which is something they don't really teach in American history class, I guess, because there weren't many Americans around. But there was an NHK national.
There's television. No world that exists outside of America. What are you talking about?
Yeah, it was funny. They had a NHK evening drama about that war, you know, about 5-6 years ago. It was just jarring because they would show the British and American military consultants, and then they come in and start speaking English. So, you know, when you're watching a Japanese show, that's kind of jarring. And then the accents were usually like not quite right because they don't know.
That's kind of funny.
Yeah, so it's like the British guy sounds vaguely American, the American sounds British. It's like, eh, they mixed that up, didn't they?
Yeah, they all sound and look the same.
Well, yeah, they sound. I mean, it's like how we would have trouble hearing different accents in like a different language. You know, it took me a few years before I could even, like, East and West Japan, there's definitely kind of a different accent, but I couldn't hear that for a few years, you know? Basically,
that's a good point, especially like you get to like Midwestern US where like there's an Ohio accent and a Michigan accent and a Virginian accent, but they would all sound identical if you were coming from like Europe where, you know, no one sounded like any of those things.
Yeah. The thing that helps with the West, the Kansai accent, is just they sound like way happier. Like they always sound like they're joking, whereas people in East Japan tend to sound a little more like, you know, monotone.
But, which one is the car factory accent?
Oh, probably the Kansai one. If you're selling a car, you want the happy one, right?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Do you have any more notes on your thing? I've gotten to the end of mine, so.
No, I thought that was interesting, too, where they brought up China, and they were showing like the mountains and the swamps. Because I was just thinking, like, oh, I wonder if when they were making this, they were making notes and like, oh, here's how we would invade China. And, you know, here's the Disney sort of animations on how to get into China.
Well, you were talking about how Russia is basically an ally at this point. But again, General Patton, after they, you know, took their part of Germany, I guess they didn't make it all the way to Berlin. But he was like, let's just keep going.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't wrong, but whatever. Yeah.
But then you would have several more years of horribly bloody war against Uncle Joe's Stalin, which wouldn't be cool.
I mean, it's easier in retrospect since I was born after all of that had already, you know, ended essentially.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess I don't know how broken Russia was at that point. I mean, they rebounded a lot, but, you know, we always have like Band of Brothers and stuff. And we don't, again, Americans don't hear much about how much more horrible the Eastern Front was. I mean,
Well,
the Western Front was fun and games compared to the Eastern Front.
I'm beyond ignorant when it comes to, like, the farther we get away from America, the more ignorant I become about history. But there was a really interesting conversation that was in the other day with I got a one friend that lives in Russia and one friend that lives in Ukraine. And we were just kind of like having a various discussion about it. But it came up that Russia's, like, just how the United States, you could almost say at this point or in recent history, essentially Desert Storm area, but America's power specifically is probably air power. Like the Air Force is kind of like the main crown jewel, essentially, of the military might, I guess. And for Russia specifically, in that sort of time period, like the KGB, even I guess Putin's early days, who's, you know, currently running Russia, but their main like military power was information and propaganda. And it wasn't necessarily like a specific way that they trained their troops or a specific technology that they had. It was just like how they can brainwash people, and not just the brainwashing, because you could say any military essentially brainwashes their people to like send them off into the battle and, you know, die for some nationalistic abstract concept. But the way that they weaponize information and compartmentalize things, Russia was able to do to such an extreme degree to where like they perfected it to the point where everything was so compartmentalized, no one could trust each other. Like, even if me and you were like working like neck and neck as two generals, like we couldn't trust each other not to be secretly plotting to kill or turn the other one in for treason and stuff. And that's kind of where it went wrong versus the allies and I guess, you know, West, quote unquote, Western world. Since they base theirs on training and technology and strategy and not just information warfare, not just propaganda, that's why that's actually why it kind of won, you know, that's why the superpowers remain superpowers. And likewise, even in this movie and the Victory Through Air Power movie, when they're mentioning Germany, they gloss over it very quickly, but they mentioned that one of the reasons why Germany could fall is because so much of their resources were being taken by force. Like they were, you know, essentially like forcing the populations and forcing the areas that they were taking over to give up their resources. And therefore, the people that were like living around Nazi Germany were just filled with disdain for Nazi Germany. And therefore, like, even if they were giving up their resources, it was almost by force. Whereas again, it was like, hey, everyone, you know, tighten your belts. We're all going to collectively and voluntarily, you know, give up our resources to this war machine. And that dynamic alone of like, hey, everyone, let's band our resources together and work as a team versus, you know, we need this, I'm taking this from you. That might have also been a huge element to the war. You know, that's kind of like the soft skills side of warfare.
Right. So this Eastern Front, you have, you know, the Germans and this, you know, paranoid culture on both ends bashing heads and just, you know, if you read, there's some tomes about Stalingrad and Leningrad, and man, talk about dire situations. Those are just like, again, Band of Brothers is like watching Mickey Mouse compared to what was going down those cities.
to end this on a really nice light note, but like what Russia was doing at that time too was starving out their more remote communities. And they would pretty much turn to cannibalism out of a necessity, like to themselves. Like people would, you know, in the most extreme versions, someone might give up a leg to like feed themselves and their family for a little while. And then the Russian authorities would come back in and be like, cannibals, you know, how disgusting are you people? You're all going to jail now for being cannibals. When it was like, but you're starving us. Like, we don't want to do this. We didn't do this because it was like something we wanted to put on our diet. It was literally the last thing that we could have done to survive. You know, how dare anyone put us to this extreme? And then Russia's like, you sickos, off to jail with you. So this extreme versus, hey, everyone, let's tighten up our belts. Let's band together. And like, maybe you're not going to get a new, you know, Chevrolet car this year because that needs to go to the war machine, but you'll get it in a few other years. That's such a different, you know, version of banding resources compared to anywhere else that was happening during this wartime.
Yeah. I guess we do need to wrap up today then. What's up in your universe? It is currently, I don't know, it's mid August.
Is it mid? Oh, okay. You're talking in the future now.
Yeah.
<I'm- laughs> What am I doing in mid August? I'm not sure yet. I guess just the run of the mill paranoidamerican.com. Oh, that's it. I've been working on a new website, although it'll be ready in a month or two from now. What's that, December? So yeah, new paranoidamerican.com. It should look and work the same, but I'm going to actually have links to like 10 new titles that have been available, but just hard to find on Amazon and coloring books and some other stuff. And then also at this point, again, we're talking in the future, The Chosen One issue one should now be available on the West Coast of United States and a handful of different small comic shops, weed dispensaries, like used music stores, just a whole bunch of cool places where you'll be able to find the comics in person and just kind of walk in and browse. So I'm pretty jazzed about that. That's exciting.
Aren't you guys East Coast or so?
I am. Yeah, we're all in Florida, but the distributor that I'm working with just happens to have a really big presence in Washington, Oregon, and some places in California, but maybe we'll expand and bring that to the East Coast. I don't know if I have the heart to actually drive around and, you know, boots on the ground knocking on doors and pitching comics, but we'll see.
Yeah, it is kind of nice to have someone just West Coast for you too.
Yeah, seriously,
this one is I guess we're start calling it a Disney podcast, but it's under the Patreon umbrella of Podcastio Podcastius, where you'll find me talking about the Twilight Zone and sci-fi films, and you'll find some gamer podcasts about Pokemon, Monster Hunter, and game shows. All right. We talk some history. We talk some strategy. I hope we were more interesting than Zabirsky, though.
We got some occult. I mean, we talked about Paperclip. We talked about Hollow Earth. We talked about Antarctica, Lusitania, Pearl Harbor conspiracy theories.
Oh, that wasn't saying that. I was just saying I hope we are more interesting than he was.
Oh, by far.
Hit the